The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia and New Jersey. Welcome to Inside Medicine for Labor Day. I have to say this, that it's a fantastic holiday, and as usual on a holiday, we get three guests to drop in and give us some insight. We're going to have initially Rich Weiss from the University of Pennsylvania. He is the director of echocardiography, where they put those jelly on your chest and put sound waves through to check out your heart. He is at Penn Presbyterian Medical Center. He's a clinical associate professor of medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Rich is going to be discussing cardiology issues. And then we're going to have seasoned gynecologist Vivian Vago, I've known for years at Inspira. Vivian has tremendous amount of clinical insight, good personality, patients love her, and she will be with us to discuss some gynecologic issues. Third on the list will be myself. I will talk about some toxic tidbits. What are some of the toxicities that kids get into? What happens with some of the newer drugs called the SGLT2? Are you prone to acidosis? What about laundry pods, do they cause kidney damage? And what about Benadryl overdoses, which TikTok has discussed? So let me just start off. Labor Day usually indicates the end of summer and the beginning of the school year. Labor Day most importantly celebrates the social and economic achievements of American workers. Let us celebrate. I have to say that I just read an article in World War II, a personal insight from U.S. soldiers, and I have to say that we are also incredibly happy to have a fantastic medicine. Inside Medicine will have a holiday spritz, as I previously mentioned. I do want to point out a few items before we start the medical component. Is there a soft landing for the economy versus the chronic 1970s-style inflation disaster? Is around the corner a recession? Question mark. How can job openings outrun unemployment workers by 5 million, so therefore we have more jobs than workers? Workers are scarce and wages are on the rise, but will you be in an employment chair when the music stops? Whatever you do or dream you can do, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic to it, per Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Poet, does there need to be a sense of urgency in everything you do? Don't just think so, do it. Did Russia, in effect, suspend a gas pipeline to Europe? Did the U.S. stock market respond downward? Why do Russian gas employees jump out of hospital windows to their death? Don't live in Russia. Labor Day is here in June. $5 gas, what is gone, which occurred, and now we have a $3.83 per gallon, which is still 66 cents per gallon over last year, according to the American AAA, highest for this time of the year in 10 decades. The good news is we live in America where Americans can still take safely a long road trip before the winter chill creeps in. Will OPEC spoil with a reduction in oil to the U.S. and the rest of the world? But we're going to go back to medicine. Dr. Rich Weiss, are you on the line? Please give us a call. You got to give us a call in at the 888-329-3306 number. Let me just talk about DKA from SGLT2 inhibitors. So one of the most popular drugs now are SGLT2 inhibitors for diabetes. These drugs include examples of empagliflozin, canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, and they've made a tremendous impact on cardiovascular death, improved kidney function, and improved diabetic control. One of the side effects of these drugs is that because of these drugs make you lose sugar through your urine, the body needs to compensate as it counted on that fuel to arrive. And when that happens, the body has to compensate by increasing free fatty acid or fat reduction. This generates, this oxidation problem generates significant ketone bodies, which classically would be called diabetic ketoacidosis. The main issue is that this is rare, can occur, usually occurs when people reduce their insulin because these drugs are so effective at improving glucose metabolism that insulin needs in diabetics go down, down, down. When this occurs, acidosis occurs, and there is certain downflow feeds such as glucagon goes up, which generates more ketone production, and people can go into DKA. The classic thing for physicians is this is a low blood sugar diabetic ketoacidosis and really has to be picked up very quickly. Patients are treated in the emergency room with IV insulin drips, hydration with salt, and any issues such as dehydration has to be taken into account. Again, insulin drops because of the fact that these drugs decrease urinary excretion of sugar, and this can be aggravated at the same time when someone is drinking alcohol. I should point out that anyone who is going to have surgery on an SGLT2 drug generally is advisable that they discontinue their SGLT2 drug maybe 2 to 3 days before one goes to surgery. Again, DKA can be part of this picture with these drugs, especially those who reduce their insulin less than 20 units a day if they're on insulin. And it's just very, very important to be aware of those drugs. Now, I tell you, these drugs also basically can preserve kidney function. There's now 4 drugs on the market for kidney preservation, which is very important. And I always love, every day I'm in the office, I tell people that their kidneys are getting better, which is fantastic. These drugs are significantly responsible for preservation of kidney function. There is also the drugs that have been on the market for 20 years, the ACEs and the ARBs. So they have two drug categories that can preserve kidney function in diabetics. We have the SGLT2 drugs, and also we have a drug called Kerendia, which is new to the market and doing marvelous effects on kidney function. So if you're a diabetic, talk to your doctor about an SGLT2 drug inhibitor. They do phenomenal work. Let me just also talk about cylindrical battery ingestions. So this is usually a kidney issue, but some people can intentionally do this. But overall, inadvertent ingestion of button batteries in pediatrics is a major concern due to the potential for severe esophageal and gastrointestinal injuries. So watch those button batteries. The problem is that cylindrical batteries, AAA, AAA, C, and D cells, can also be viewed as less harmful than button batteries, but toxic effects can still occur under many conditions. Cylindrical battery ingestions commonly occur in adults and are often intentional in the setting of incarceration or psychiatric illness. Cylindrical batteries can be divided into 2 categories, those that cause physical obstruction, especially getting stuck in their stomach or airway, and they can also cause large bowel obstruction also. The corrosive effects of these metal compounds vary by battery, but the most commonly ones, zinc, lithium, mercury, nickel, and cadmium, are uncommon. The major issue is if things get stuck for 48 hours, a lot of times extraction is recommended, but overall the Poison Centers of America have found that cylindrical batteries can stay in the stomach longer than 48 hours and can be treated conservatively. Sometimes it takes a long time for these batteries to traverse the GI tract. So again, systemic absorption of heavy metals from cylindrical batteries are rare. In an analysis of 2,300 battery ingestions, mostly button and cylindrical, 9 patients had blood or urine mercury determinations. Only 1 patient had a significant level, Mercury-containing batteries, when ingested, had a measurable urine and blood mercury levels, but basically, luckily, are asymptomatic. You have to watch those kids with the batteries, especially the button batteries. Another issue that has come up is ocular exposure to laundry pods. So liquid laundry detergent capsules, also known as single-use detergent sacks or pods, have been a common pediatric exposure since 2011 when they were released in the United States. Ingredients differ among manufacturers, but there's various concentrations of anionic surfactants, propylene glycol, and ethanol encapsulated in a water-soluble polyvinyl alcohol membrane. Unintentional ingestion in pediatric patients is the most frequent reported route of exposure, i.e. over 85%, and generally produce mild symptoms such as vomiting and coughing in the young kids. Uncommon cases of significant symptoms, including CNS depression, respiratory depression, and corrosive injury, have been reported. Ocular exposures, which account for 15% of all pediatric exposures, have the potential to cause significant eye injuries. These pods, the capsules are compressed and fairly pliable, but not intended to withstand forceful pressure from sharp objects. Ocular exposure generally occurs when a child is playing with the capsule and squeezing causes it to rupture and spray in the eye and face. It may be more common among children 2 to 5 years than those less than 2 years due to the need for dexterity and strength. Once the detergents come in contact with the eye, ophthalmologic damage is primarily caused by high concentrations of the surfactants, causing direct injury to the cells. Approximately 75% of the ocular exposures will result in some effect, mainly conjunctivitis, i.e. irritation of the eye in white part, but corneal injury, which is a risk, and abrasion can occur in varying frequencies, 3 to 12% of kiddies. The most common type of preservative, benzothiazolene, is a known skin-sensitive and irritant. Most authors believe that the pH of the detergent seemed to play a lesser role in injury, as the pH of the products generally between 6 and 9, similar to soaking, is unlikely to cause an alkaline burn. After an ocular exposure on a youngster, thoroughly irrigate the eyes with water. Remember, put the water in from the outside across the eye towards the nose. Isotonic solutions are ideal, but water basically is important, and it's available and can be helpful. Rich, are you on board? It looks like Rich is not. Let me talk about a Benadryl challenge. So there is a dangerous new game that kids are playing called the Benadryl challenge. Apparently, social media app with TikTok dare teens to take as many Benadryl tablets as necessary to hallucinate while capturing it on video to share with others. As a result of the challenge, several adolescents have been treated in emergency departments, and a 15-year-old Oklahoma girl reportedly died. The FDA has issued a warning about the challenge, and the agency is in reviewing cases. This is easily accessible Benadryl, diphenhydramine. It's a non-prescription of antitussives, nighttime sleep aids, and allergy relief medications. It's associated with some sedation, but obviously some people can generate a high. Recreational use has been well documented and is associated with the drug's ability to elevate mood, increase energy levels, and in higher doses to produce hallucinogenic effects. Diphenhydramine doses greater than 7.5 milligram per kilogram or 300 milligrams in children and adolescent adults can result in anticholinergic toxicity, which can be life-threatening. Neurologic symptoms may advance from agitation, drowsiness to hallucinations, something what the kids want, but it's just a little bit too risky. We do note that acetaminophen levels generally, which are associated with diphenhydramine, typically peak in 4 hours, and acute ingestions can result in prolonged absorption of acetaminophen. And generally, poison centers recommend that you have to have an acetaminophen level every 4 hours till a toxic level is reduced. So TikTok and Benadryl challenges are not a good idea. I do want to push a little bit towards Cooper University indicated that about 2% of the adult population harbors a brain aneurysm, and 20% of these patients have more than one brain aneurysm. So a brain aneurysm is an outpatching of one of your vessels. And of course, the brain is a very tight area. We've got a bony capsule that kind of like constricts everything. And when you have a leak in a small vessel in the brain, that can cause swelling and significant neurodysfunction. Generally, brain aneurysms, which are present, which are an outpouching of a vessel in the brain, usually causes no symptoms, and many are discovered only after they rupture, i.e. a bit too late for many. Unfortunately, approximately 30,000 Americans suffer bleeding from brain aneurysms each year. When brain aneurysms rupture, they can be fatal or cause devastating neurologic injury, and time is critically important in getting patients to the right center for care. One is hopeful that you will detect your aneurysms by a study prior. Brain aneurysms can be detected by MR angiography. That means more or less they send the dye through and watch the dye go through your blood vessels. CT, which is less expansive, CT angiography can also be done. And digital subtraction, getting really fancy, is the gold standard for aneurysm detection. Aneurysms generally need to have an approach. Of course, these will be not the acute side, but acute side definitely needs it. But basically, you're going to need neurosurgeons, neuroradiologists, neurovascular physicians to try and put a limitation to the damage to the brain that's caused. Cooper Center indicates that they have significant expertise with their physician environment, nursing environment, and overall care environment, and the equipment necessary to diagnose and treat. Rich, are you on at all? So it looks like we don't have Rich. So I just want to move forward a little bit and discuss another item, which is bone health. So the bone health has improved dramatically in the population, and in my patients, I've been incredibly happy to intervene to make sure that bones don't break. Remember that backs break, not really a break, but they more or less get crushed nerves coming out of the spinal cord, which causes significant problems. Some people will break a hip. We know that hip fractures are associated with a significant mortality because of the lack of movement, which generates significant risk. So what has come about, you know, maybe way over 10 years ago, the drugs called bisphosphonates came to the U.S. market, which were a phenomenal benefit. Anybody who has taken bisphosphonates for over 5 years generally has been placed on what they call a drug holiday. Bone is monitored by something called a DEXA scan, where they shoot an X-ray through your hip and compare it to a ghost, i.e. the ghost is someone your own age and a ghost is somebody at 30. You peak your bone mass at 30 years of age. So what they do is they calculate your bone density or how much bone you have per area to someone who is your own age, and of course to someone who is 30, where most people peak their bone mass at 30 years of age. So there are certain issues that make someone at high risk, like are you a smoker? Do you have a family history where your bones have leached out in other family members? Do you inadvertently not have enough vitamin D intake, either through the sun or through taking an over-the-counter, very inexpensive vitamin D? We usually recommend between 2,000 international units and 5,000. And of course, you have to also watch about alcohol intake, mainly because it can be too many falls. And of course, walking an hour a day really does help bone health tremendously. There is a test called the DEXA scan, and that basically will give you a 10-year risk of a major osteoporotic fracture and a hip fracture. Now, when those numbers go up, doctors get alarmed. A hip fracture results in a significant mortality and morbidity and is certainly a problem. So what came out over 10 years ago was a drug called Fosamax made by Merck. Merck did a phenomenal job. They saw that an earlier drug that they saw in mice had resulted in mice, when they were fed for toxicity, basically increased the bone density, so it was a fortuitous event. And it was then later applied and initially mobilized by Merck Sharp and Dohme. And this generated where we could tell somebody what your five-year risk of a hip fracture is or a five-year risk of a spine fracture. Those fractures result in compression of nerves, which cause pain. And we've had a number of orthopedic doctors on that demonstrate that that is a significant problem. So what happens is that the question is there a toxicity? So after 5 years of utilizing a drug such as Fosamax or Risedronate, the main two players in the marketplace, and then there is an IV one, zoledronic acid, which basically is given once a year. The issue is how do we make sure that we get high benefit and no loss? So it turns out that if you take the drugs for over 5 years, a lot of people say you should take a drug holiday, so basically you're going to take the pharmaceutical drug. That's going to basically help build bone, and the hope is there would be no toxicity. But after about 8 years, there was a finding that some people would develop abnormal bone, especially in their femur area, which is the upper leg. And if you had a fracture there, it was almost as bad as a regular hip fracture, which is a little higher up on the bone. But if you got this fracture, you were kind of stuck because basically it required major surgery. If you had that fracture, they would usually put a metal rod in. And the problem was they were also fearful that the other leg would later have succumbed to the same issue of a fracture down below the hip. So therefore, people were getting double rotted. Now, nobody likes to get double rotted. That's a big surgery. And I did have one patient who suffered from this. But the goal was, they call it an atypical fracture, and these atypical fractures required surgery. So there was a little hubbub conference at the FDA, and that was about 8 years, and the overall came up was, should patients get a drug holiday? So that came into focus. So after 5 years of utilizing a bisphosphonate like Fosamax or Risedronate, which is Actonil, people would take a drug holiday for 1 or 2 years, and they had a big FDA hubbub meeting, and the result was they felt that it wasn't necessary, at least as of that meeting, that you don't really need to take a drug holiday, and then if you had significant osteoporosis, you can move forward. So this was debated in the New England Journal of Medicine, and that was in 2022, April. There was a very nice article by Dr. Leslie Chang and by Dr. Paul Miller, both experts in osteoporosis. One was, you don't need to take a drug holiday. One was, you should take a drug holiday. And the bottom line is that I would say most clinicians at the present time, after 5 years of Fosamax or Risedronate, will take a drug holiday of 1 or 2 years. Once you see an increase in CTLA-O peptide, which means that the bone is starting to resorb quicker, usually a lot of people will be very happy to have the drugs re-added, whether it be Fosamax or Risedronate, or if somebody has somebody's a challenged patient, they can get the IV zoledronic acid, which is an infusion once a year, which is less than 15 minutes. So the overall deal is that if you have bones and you're on one of these agents, you can also try and get a CTLA-O peptide, which is a blood draw, i.e. it's a bone marker. And additionally, you should get your DEXA scans every 2 years to make sure that if you see an increase of bone loss that's of significance, that you can reintroduce these medications. So overall, we would say that the evidence remains insufficient to reliably predict fracture risk after discontinuation of these molecules, which are retained and at times recycled in the bones, and that there also is that risk of osteonecrosis of the jaw, which is basically treated by good dental hygiene And that generates a low risk of a loss of bone, and that the patient overall gains. I will say this, my impression is that the bisphosphonates have proven to be a major help in gals not losing height. Notice this is generally a gal thing because the gals lose more bone once they lose their estrogen than the men. But men who also lose testosterone can also have a similar situation. So again, bone density is important, getting your DEXA scan. Follow-up is important. When 5 year comes around, still taking the medicine, it might be a good idea to discuss with your physician whether you're going to be a continue or not continue because of the risk of atypical fractures and, of course, of some jaw issues. That's why the dentists get hop in here. Rich, are you there? Oh, Vivian is here. We're going to ask Vivian Vega, who is a seasoned gynecologist, to hop in. Vivian is, I've known her for over 20 years. She's cool, calm, and collected. She's a very generous gal, and she also has a son who went to MIT, so you know she's smart, unless her husband gave it all. And I'm sure that's not the case because I know Vivian. So, Vivian, welcome to Inside Medicine.
Thanks, Joe. It's nice to be here for you.
I really appreciate it. So give us a little scoop. Where do you practice and how many people do you see in terms of, and what do you see them for?
So I have a general OBGYN practice. We have four offices, Woodbury, Mullica Hill, Woolwich, and Elmer, so all over the South Jersey area. We do general OBGYN. I have been in this practice for the last 34 years, so I have been seeing the same women for years and years and years. And a lot of new patients. I have a lot of young patients, and we're enjoying that, too. It's kind of the circle of life. You have babies. I deliver the babies to babies I delivered, and it just keeps going. It's a lot of fun.
Fantastic. So you've got a lot of experience and a great way of getting patients to understand what's going on. So is there anything new in birth control?
So birth control has changed over the years. Everybody thinks of birth control specifically as the birth control pills. We have had birth control pills for the last 50-plus years. What has changed in it is the amount of medication in it. A birth control pill is a combination, in most cases, of estrogen and progesterone. Years ago, we had very high estrogen pills, and those people never had, you could miss pills for weeks and you'd never have breakthrough bleeding, things like that. But they were also at a higher risk to get a blood clot in their leg and problems like that from the high doses of estrogen. So over the years, the American College of OBGYN has been working with the drug companies. We've lowered the amount of estrogen. So from what used to be 50 to 75 micrograms of estrogen, now we're down to anywhere between 10 and 30, which is a significant difference. It means that patients taking birth control pills don't have to take what we used to call a pill holiday, what you were talking about before, stopping for a little while and giving the body a chance to rest. So they can just stay on. If a young girl gets on birth control pills for problems with her periods at age 14, she can stay on the birth control pills till she's ready to have a baby, get off, have the baby, and get back on. Or she can, if she decides never to have a child, she can stay on those birth control pills up until she's ready to go through the change of life in her 50s. We also have other methods of birth control. There's progesterone-only methods. Those would be a shot that somebody gets every 12 weeks. What some patients like about the shot medication is that you don't get a period. After the second shot, most people don't get a period because we're not building up the lining. So it's not like you're doing something harmful to the body. You're just not building up the lining of the uterus. And so patients get this shot every 12 weeks, keeps them from getting pregnant. They don't get periods. So if they had bad cramps with their periods, now they don't have a period and they don't have their cramps. There is also a progesterone-only pill for women who are at high risk for blood clots. That's effective. There is also a progesterone implant. So we're talking about, when we talk about implants, we're talking about what we call LARCs, long-acting reversible contraception. For somebody who's young and knows they don't want to have children for the next 3 years, they can consider one of these methods. That would be something like an IUD or an implant in the arm. The implant in the arm, called Nexplanon, goes right underneath the skin. It's something that the patient can feel, but it's not visible. Somebody looking at you isn't going to say, oh, I see she has a birth control rod in her arm. It lasts for 3 years. It is also associated with occasionally not getting your period at all, but most people do have cycles, although much lighter, with that method of birth control. It can be changed in 3 years. We can take it out and put another one right back in the same spot. It's painless to go in. It takes about 2 minutes in the doctor's office. IUDs, there's two different types. There's a copper-containing IUD that works for 10 years. With that copper-containing IUD, patients get their cycles every month. So for some people, they really want birth control that's going to be long-acting, but they also want to be able to see that period because that tells them that, yes, they are still, they are not pregnant. That gets put in the doctor's office. If in any time in that 10 years you decide you want a baby, you come back in. It takes us about 10 seconds to take it out. There's a little string that sticks out of the cervix. The patient can't truly feel it. Neither can their partner. And it's very easily reversible. The second type...
Wait, can I ask you one thing?
Sure.
Are these people, how is their bone protection? In other words, with these areas of not getting pregnant, is their bone still protected by these methods?
Well, one of the things I do tell people who are on the progesterone-only methods for a long time, that they should make sure they're taking their calcium and vitamin D. We're talking about young, healthy, active girls in the most cases, so they do get their stress on their bones to help improve their bones. But no, after 5 to 10 years, it can start to have a little bit of bone loss if they're not careful and making sure they're getting calcium and vitamin D in their diet. And I talk to them about that. But for the 10 years, you're pretty good. It's after 10 years if you're going to stand that. Now, the estrogen, progesterone, birth control pills, that's not a problem because you're getting the estrogen that helps your body absorb the calcium and vitamin D and build the bone.
Fantastic. Thank you.
The second IUD that I just wanted to talk about is a progesterone-containing IUD. We use that not only for birth control, but for women that are having problems with their periods. It goes up inside the uterus. It has progesterone in it, so most people don't get periods, and that works for 7 to, depending on the type, which one you get, approximately 7 years, again, for birth control.
So people have a lot of options, and I guess you can never tell what someone's going to want until you give the presentation and tell them what are the available agents and mechanisms of action.
Right. What I always tell people is the best method of birth control is the one that you can remember. And so the benefit of the IUDs or the implant in the arm is you don't ever have to remember to do anything. Birth control pills you have to take every day. There's a birth control ring, same estrogen and progesterone that goes in the vagina. You change it once a month, so that's easier. It's only once a month to remember. There's a patch you put on your skin that you change every week. And, again, so those are user-dependent. You have to remember to change it. You have to remember to put a new one on. That's where most of the pregnancies occur with birth control, is a user failure. They forget to take the birth control pill. They forget to put the patch on. They forget to change the ring. With the long-acting reversible ones, there's nothing for them to forget. It's taken care of by the doctor.
So is there a breakdown on what gals do, like there's some 25% of this, 30% of that? Is there any breakdown what most people choose?
Most people choose the birth control pills because it's something that they're comfortable, they've heard about, their mothers knew about. But most women, after they've had a baby and they know that they want to hold off, they're very happy with IUD. So it really is age dependent and how much the person doesn't want to get pregnant. If you have a young girl who is really concerned about getting pregnant and knows they don't want to have a baby, they're more apt to get an IUD even before they've had a child.
Got it. So is there anything you can do for gals who have very heavy menstrual bleeding? I'm sure that's a complaint that comes through your door.
Heavy menstrual bleeding is one of the most common things we see people for. So when I talk to patients about it, I talk to them about the different things that can cause it. You can have fibroids, which are a benign tumor of the uterus. They're like little solid balls of uterine muscle. And they can increase the lining, the amount of the lining, if they're in the lining of the uterus. And the uterus can't contract as well, so you bleed heavier and longer. there's polyps that could be up inside the uterus, and then just some people just have heavier cycles than others. For heavy cycles, we often talk to the patients about three things. One is a birth control pill, because that definitely will lighten their periods. Another thing that people can do is there's medication out there that they can just take that helps decrease their period, how heavy it is. And also taking an anti-inflammatory, ibuprofen, sometimes helps people lower their periods. Along with that, we also offer them, as we talked about, the Depo-Provera injection, because if you don't get your period, then you don't have to worry about heavy bleeding. We talk about that progesterone-containing IUD. Women that are done with their childbearing, knowing that they don't want to have any more children, have another option. It's a surgical option, what we call a uterine ablation. We place a rod up into the uterus, and it has an electric current that goes through, and it burns the lining of the uterus. Most women, after having this ablation, have lighter, much lighter periods. Some don't even get periods at all, and it is a surgical procedure that is minimally invasive. It's done in the office in most cases, so no anesthesia, no nothing, and if this works for you, it's a great way to do it. Alternatively, if none of those other things work or there are contraindications for any of those other things, the last option would always be a hysterectomy. But as I tell my patients, a hysterectomy, although it is one of the most common procedures performed in the United States today, is not without risks because you're removing things that had support systems. So your vagina can drop down, the rectum can drop, you can have your bladder drop and then start having urine loss. So all those things can come across after you've removed the uterus. So you need to be careful before you choose that option, because some people say, I don't want to use it anymore. Why don't I just take it out? Well, if you can treat it with the ablation and not take it out, you're in a much better place because you're leaving the support ligaments that were put in there when you were born.
So I think they call that, how good your pelvic floor is. Am I right or wrong on that?
That's correct. And we talk about pelvic floor exercises and things like that you can do. But once you take the uterus out, there's not much that you could do to strengthen it.
Really?
People, after that, if they start having droppage, they're going to need to have either a mesh sling or their bladder elevated by a urologist.
I see. So again, you have to really think hard if you're going to request a hysterectomy because of that pelvic floor issue.
And that's what I always tell people, but some people choose that anyway, and there are a significant portion of women that never have a problem after having a hysterectomy. It really depends on your anatomy and how strong your tissue strength is to begin with. But we don't know how strong your tissue strength is until we remove things.
Gotcha. So people always talk about mesh. Gals talk about, I was recommended to have mesh put in. Can you explain what that is? Because I don't know the answer.
Sure. Mesh is it looks like a ribbon, and it is put in between the fascia and the vaginal wall, and it goes around, and it's hooked usually to your bones, and it's going to hold up the bladder, or it's going to hold back the rectum. Positives about the mesh is that your body then builds up tissue around it, gets some scar tissue, and it can work, in some people can work amazingly. The negatives about the mesh, in rare cases, you can get some erosion, so the vagina can wear away, and then the mesh could be palpable in the vagina, which could be uncomfortable with intercourse and things like that. Everybody is different. The urogynecologists and urologists I refer to, all of them are very happy with the mesh. There was one mesh that was taken off the market because it had more complications for patients. But since then, the patients that have had the mesh have been very happy with the results.
So is there a specific name to that mesh, or just people?
There's very multiple different names for the mesh depending on which one they choose to use. But that's when we're talking about the mesh, we're talking about a bladder sling. Some people say, I had a sling. Well, that's what it is. It's a mesh that's working as a little sling, or think of it as a hammock that's holding your bladder up.
Got it. Okay, so let me just ask that. So when someone has a hysterectomy, is there more than one kind of hysterectomy, or there's only one?
No, absolutely. In today's day and age, the majority of cases, in my office, probably 95% of all hysterectomies are done what we call minimally invasive. A minimally invasive hysterectomy is either done laparoscopically or robotically. So you get multiple little tiny incisions in your belly, and then we're looking through a telescope in the laparoscopic case, in the robotic case, we're watching, the robot is working with us, and your uterus is removed. The actual removal of the uterus comes out through the vagina, so there's not that big incision in the belly. Now, some people still are going to need to have an open hysterectomy. That's the traditional one that people think of, where you have the bikini cut that, or the cut from your belly button down, where we cut you open and take it out. Usually the only reason to have an open hysterectomy is if you have a uterus that is very, very large, bigger than a 20-week size pregnancy. It's very hard to get those out, although my partner, Dr. Hapner, robotically removes uteruses up to 28 weeks, so that's like the size of a 7-month pregnancy if you think about it. The robotic cases have actually changed the way OBGYN is being practiced today because they have made life so much easier. If you have a robotic or a laparoscopic hysterectomy, most people are back up moving around without any pain at all within 2 to 5 days. With an open hysterectomy, it's variable, but most people with an open hysterectomy, it takes them a couple of weeks to recover, and their pain is a lot higher. We do try, though, nowadays, we have what we call early recovery after surgery, and we try to avoid giving narcotics because of the high risk of people starting to become dependent on it. We treat your pain mostly with aspirin and Tylenol with great results.
So how do you make that presentation to a patient? Do you say, look, I can do it this way, or somebody can do it robotically? How do you make that presentation?
Yeah, well, first of all, you've examined the patient, so you know how big their uterus is, how good the support to the uterus is, because you can feel all of those things, and then you tell the patient the best options. What I tell them, a lot of people come in and they say, I want to have a robotic surgery. I've seen the YouTube. Everybody goes onto YouTube. I've seen the YouTube presentations of it. It looks like the type of thing I want. Or other people say, I know I want a laparoscopic hysterectomy. My girlfriend had it, and she was back up. She was back to work in less than 2 weeks and feeling great. But we basically talk about what the pathology is that we're trying to take care of. Even with cancer cases, the cancer doctors, we refer a lot of them over there to Cooper, to the Memorial Sloan Kettering, and they do the majority of their cancer cases robotically. They will robotically take out the uterus. They'll do the lymph node dissections if they need to. Anything that needs to be done, the robot can help you do. So robotics has changed the face of surgery in every specialty across the board. They are using robots for orthopedic surgeries. They're using robots for general surgery. They're using robots for prostate surgery. They're using robots for heart surgery and brain surgery. It takes away some of the human problems that go along with it because it's a robot and it can figure things out a little better. It plans things. The robot can see the anatomy in the bones. That's why it's great with orthopedics, things like that. But, it's basically a conversation with the patient to see what their thoughts are and what they want. I will tell you there are some patients that still say, regardless, I want to have an open hysterectomy, that I want you to be able to see everything, touch everything. Because that's why some doctors have had a big push against it. It's because they feel that using the laparoscope or using the robot, you don't have that human feel. You don't feel the tissue. You can't feel what's going on.
So I'm curious, do the young gynecologists, OBs, as their training in open work decreased tremendously, is their pre getting into the business training decreased and that everything is going by robotics?
Absolutely. And one of the problems in the residency today is that there's, with the robot, very few attendings are going to be able to give up the, or going to be willing to give up their seat at the robot and let a resident do it. So there's, they have to, after they finish, they've seen, they've assisted in all these robotic cases, and then they're just going to have to take a course afterwards. There are multiple courses out there that actually teach you what else you need to do. So it really helps to have seen it and be there. But a lot of these young docs are never going to be able to do an open hysterectomy, and that is going to go by the wayside, which is probably a good thing for the patients.
So then just tell me what are the negatives to this wonderful robotic movement? Are there any negatives? Can you have bleeding that you can't see when you enter? Are there any negatives to the robotic surgery?
The biggest negative is it's a longer operating time, so you're under anesthesia longer. That's, you know, that's probably the biggest negative that's there. Actually, with the robot and with the laparoscope, you can see better than with the naked eye.
Okay, got it. So, Vivian, you basically gave a good sell there for the robotics, and I didn't know it was that clean and cut, so I thank you. How about one of the favorite thing complaints I get is hot flashes. What magic can you work for hot flashes?
There is no absolute magic cure, and that's what I tell patients. I tell them everybody is different. You know, obviously the gold standard, if somebody is completely miserable and they can't sleep, they can't work, they can't do anything, you know, we have to give them estrogen. And if you have a uterus still, then you have to take both estrogen and progesterone. The progesterone protects the uterus from turning into cancer, because if you take estrogen alone, you increase the risk of uterine cancer. So, you know, I always tell people you have to decide how bad things are. I like to start off and telling my patients that the first thing I would like them to do is to try the soy and black cohosh products that are available. And I do tell all my patients that you don't need the brand names of things. The over-the-counter Acme brand or Rite Aid brand is just as good. And the majority of people will find that by taking the black cohosh, it decreases their hot flashes to a point that they're comfortable with. Because what you want to do, obviously we can't take everything away, but if you have a woman who's had breast cancer or has a very strong family history of breast cancer, they're going to be a little nervous about taking estrogens, as they rightly should. So this gives them options of things to try. I also tell them decreasing caffeine helps with getting rid of hot flashes. And there are some drugs that we use now. It's being used off-label, but a lot of antidepressants, a side effect that was found by women that were taking the antidepressants for actual depression was that their hot flashes went away. So there, we often try that as another non-hormonal method, and that gives a significant relief to patients. But it is something they have to take every day for the rest of their lives. And what I always tell people is you could take the estrogen for 10 years and stop it, and your hot flashes will be just as bad as before you started. It doesn't cure it. It just helps it during the time that you're taking the medication.
So what's your favorite thing that you do in OB-GYN?
My favorite, I love to deliver the babies. The happiness and the family connection is amazing.
I love it. Okay.
You know, it's a connection that lasts forever. Everybody remembers their delivery, and they remember the doctor that did it. And so that, to me, it's that connection that you build with a patient, and you keep it with them.
Okay. And so what do you think about, I was talking a little bit earlier about the bisphosphonates. Any comments from a gynecologic perspective about use of bisphosphonates when somebody has a history of fractures in their family?
I always offer that as a first-line option to my patients. You know, we see a significant number of women that don't see any other doctor other than, you know, their gynecologist. So I order the bone scan, and then I talk to them about their fracture risk afterwards. And I do explain to them that, you know, you taking a bisphosphonate by itself isn't the where all in all. You have to make sure that you're getting calcium, vitamin D, and weight-bearing exercise to keep those bones strong, because if you're going to be very sedentary, sitting around, not getting any calcium or vitamin D in your diet, not going outside into the sunshine, you're even taking all the bisphosphonates you want, it's not going to help your bones that much.
So you got to use that right combination of raw materials and medication to try and make sure that your bones last until you die.
Absolutely. And that's the one thing I tell them, that women are a significant risk once they have osteoporosis of a hip fracture. The hip fracture is one of the more common causes that people end up eventually in a nursing home because they can't get around.
Gotcha. Now, what about gestational diabetes? Because I know you take care of a ton of people. How has that worked out with your patients? Do they sense the urgency that they have to just get good sugars? Are they compliant? They're pregnant.
You know, I would say the majority of patients are very, very compliant because they're concerned about the baby's safety, and they know this is short term. But what I do try to stress to all my patients is once you've had gestational diabetes, that increases your risk, and you have to be cognizant that for the rest of your life, you're at a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes. You need to follow up with your family doctor afterwards. We always get now a 2-hour glucose challenge 6 months after the delivery if they've had gestational diabetes to see. I often, on some of those patients who had a history of it, I'll check a hemoglobin A1C on them because if they're not seeing anybody else, I'm the only one who's going to find their diabetes and send them out. Today, we test everybody at 24 weeks for gestational diabetes. Most of the patients do well with diet alone. They get close monitoring by our maternal fetal medicine doctors, who are constantly sending, with today's day and age, they email their sugar logs, and the doctors will tell them, we start them on medication. Sometimes it's an oral medication, sometimes it's insulin, depending on how bad their sugars are. But we do talk to them about the risks. And when patients hear that the risks of gestational diabetes include the risk of stillbirth, they're more likely to be compliant because they want this baby. They don't want to do anything to hurt the baby.
Well, I think that's called maternalistic, which is tremendous. So let me just ask you this, Vivian. You've been in the business a while. Do you think it's been rewarding?
Absolutely. I love what I do, or I wouldn't still be doing it 38 years later. I enjoy taking care of women. What I like about OBGYN is that I have been seeing, as I said, I've been in the same practice for the last 34 years since I finished my residency. I have some patients that I have been seeing for 34 years where they're kind of like friends. When they come in, we talk about their family. We talk about what's going on in their lives. I get to deliver their grandchildren. It's a very rewarding, and I feel like I'm making a difference in the world. That's another thing, because I think that I can direct young women and give them some positive reinforcement and some positive ideas of their own body image.
That's fantastic. So, Vivian, tell me, where can people get in touch with you if they have an interest in making you their OB-GYN?
So my practice is called Premier Women's Health of South Jersey. It's a part of Axia Women's Healthcare. All they need to do is call 856-223-8930, and they will be able to get an appointment in the practice. We are all taking new patients. We do have 7 providers in the practice, and we, as I said, we have 4 offices, so depending on where in the Gloucester, Salem, Cumberland, or Burlington County you are, we'll pick which office you want to come to.
Fantastic. So, Vivian, thanks you for hopping on. We really appreciate it, and please keep on practicing, okay?
All righty. Thanks, Joe. You guys have a nice weekend. Bye.
All right. So we have the infamous holiday is here, and I just want to make sure that everybody pays attention to their diet, that we just heard about how important it is for gestational diabetics, and, of course, we have a very high compliance there. But one of the most important things to do is not to stop your diabetic medicine. Is important thing to do is to keep those carbs low. The important thing, I think, is to basically make sure that you don't enjoy too much corn, because I always complain that they put the concentration of corn up to about 67% sugar these days. We used to recommend eat popcorn if you were a diabetic at night, because you'll get something that's got high volume but no calories, but that's changed around. So you have to deep six the infamous corn, even though there's no such thing as knee-high by the 4th of July. It's way over that at this point. Additionally, one of the things that always comes up in my office is peanut butter. So peanut butter is really, everybody thinks it's a great thing. The only problem is that most of the commercial peanut butters are loaded with sugar. And do you really want to feed yourself George Washington Carver's peanuts, where he basically made sure it was high-quality protein, very beneficial for overall health. And George Washington Carver never told people to put a ton of sugar into the peanut butter jar. Remember that if you're buying peanut butter and the oil is on the top, that means that they basically grind at the peanut. The oil automatically comes out, and of course, if you decide to add sugar into it so the kids like it better, are you doing them a favor? I always think that peanut butter on celery is great for diabetics at night, but not the ones that are sold commercially. The number one and two sellers are loaded with sugar. Additionally, when you grind a peanut, you get oil coming out of the peanuts. It's kind of like an amazing thing. And when the oil comes out, what they do is make sure that, people don't like the idea that there's going to be oil there. So what they do is they put in talum, which is not good for your heart, to soak up the oil. So again, peanut butter is great for kids. It's great for adults, but not the stuff that they put talum in to suck up the oil when the peanut is cracked and the oil comes out, and not when they put a ton of sugar in. So you can always get your, quote, they say organic, but it's the natural peanut butter. It'll have some oil on the top. So make sure that you swish that around, and then you're going to need a high-quality product. Now, another item that comes up in my practice is the infamous bagel. I cannot believe how many people love bagels. I love bagels too, but it's just not for me. You have to remember that those bagels are loaded with sugar. So please, if you're a diabetic, try and put bagels, give it to somebody else. They are just nasty for high carbs. So please put the bagels somewhere else. Your sugars will be a lot easier. I need to use less medicine. And even somebody on insulin, using less insulin pays, because that insulin can put weight on you. Now, we do want to make sure that everybody hits good goals. Diabetics have really improved dramatically. The results, like Vivian's talking about with the girls who are pregnant, used to have very big babies. That doesn't occur anymore because they get checked out by maternal fetal medicine. They get reimbursement from people like Vivian Vega to make sure that you don't have too many carbs. You're not supposed to starve, but you're supposed to eat well and make good choices. Another item is you can always tap one of your dietitians to make sure that your weight is good. Remember that obesity is big. Remember that obesity is associated with a significant number of complications such as higher cancer risk. It's incredible. Diabetes mellitus, complications of surgery, etc. So we want to point out that Diabetes Living Today will be back next week on Inside Medicine. We want to make sure that people tune in. Remember, we have a podcast, www.wwdbam.com. You basically hit Inside Medicine and go to podcast. Remember, there's 120 shows up if you want to get educated. Thank you very much. Joseph Fallon Jr., MD, signing off. See you guys next week. Happy Labor Day. Carry on.